Luke chapter 19. And we're going to start in verse 29. But before we start reading the passage, I want you to understand the context of what is happening here. Okay? Most of you have heard the lesson about Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And in our teen room, before we took a break for March Madness, we were studying Jesus in the temple. And this is just the next series as it comes in line in Jesus in the temple. But let me try and help you to understand what is going on in Jerusalem. Here in Luke chapter 19, verse 29, the date is the 10th day of Nisan. Okay, that's the first month of the Jewish religious calendar. So in just a few days, on the 14th of Nisan is Passover, the day that it's time to kill the Passover lamb. The Jews, up to this point, they've been practicing this for thousands of years. And in fact, many Jews are looking forward to practicing the Passover this year. It's one of the longest continuing holidays and celebration in the world. But on the 10th of Nisan, this is a special day. This is the day that the Passover gets rolling, because your job on this day is to select a lamb. Now, many people at this point, many people in Jewish history would have raised their own lamb, but as we're coming here to the time of Christ, not as many of the Jews are shepherds. So, in Jerusalem, in the areas around Jerusalem, there are lots of shepherds who raise lambs for the specific purpose of selling them here on this day and selling them to the people. In Jerusalem, on this day, it would have been just an unbelievable experience. Because every year, all the Jews from all around the world were required to gather in Jerusalem. So on this day, you would have had Jews from up in Galilee, a lot of farms, a lot of vineyards up there in Galilee. Of course, it was the place where Jesus was. He'd had his headquarters in Capernaum for the last couple of years. They'd seen his miracles. They knew all about him. And now they had gone down, they'd traveled down to Jerusalem for the festival. But at the same time, you'd also have many of the Jews from right there in Jerusalem would be ready to celebrate the Passover. And one of the things we don't understand, and as I was studying this passage, I got a little bit better of understanding of it, but there were lots of different groups of Jews right there in Jerusalem. There was a group called the Pharisees, and they're kind of our enemy when we teach in the Bible. But the Pharisees were guys who were wholly dedicated to the law. They ruled the synagogues. And it was in the synagogues, not the temple, in the synagogues where they would be teaching about the Old Testament law. And they taught people that you had to follow the law. And the Pharisees, to show that they followed the law, they had very special garments that they would wear, signifying that they were a Pharisee. So as you're looking at this crowd, we've got the Jews from up in Galilee, probably dressed kind of rustically like farmers. You've got the Pharisees, they're all dressed up. Another group that you had was the chief priest. Now, the chief priest here in Jerusalem was a man by the name of Caiaphas. And Caiaphas had kind of a unique job. Understand something here about the temple. Okay? The temple that Jesus was looking at was the temple that was built by Herod the Great. And it was a magnificent structure. Some people say it was the largest building on earth at that time. It would have been just an incredible sight to see. But Herod built the temple for the Jews, but with that came a lot of connections, right? When government does something for you, they always want to get something in return. Okay? And Herod the Great, he's no longer around. The Romans are in control of Jerusalem at this time. And their governor is a guy by the name of Pontius Pilate. And Pontius Pilate is tasked, his job is to keep peace in Jerusalem. And so Caiaphas is appointed by the Romans to be the high priest. Now, up until Caiaphas became the high priest, every high priest that was picked lasted 1 year. And when he began to incite the people against the Romans got rid of him. But Caiaphas is now, up to this time, he's been ruling in Jerusalem for 13 years. And Caiaphas is a master politician. He uses his control over the temple to keep the people under control. And anybody who is violating what Caiaphas thinks is right is not going to be allowed to go into the temple to celebrate the Passover. So Caiaphas is there, and as we read through the Bible, we read about the chief priests. Those are the people that work with Caiaphas. And of course, as Jesus is coming into Jerusalem, we have Romans. And the Romans, they're the Roman Empire at this time. They are now underneath the emperor, and the Romans are basically controlling Jerusalem. They are the invading power. And as Jesus is riding to Jerusalem, there is a serious Roman soldier presence, because the Romans want to have no problems during Passover. And so their soldiers are there, and those soldiers are ready. And in fact, if you study out the history, their soldiers are probably eager for something to break out so they can wipe out the Jews, just so they can be sick and be done of dealing with Jerusalem, because there's been so many problems in the city. And it's into this context that Jesus comes. He comes riding on this day. And Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that there were 256,000 lambs sacrificed during this Passover. That's one lamb per family. So how many people are in Jerusalem at this time? It's crowded. It is crowded. It is filled to overflowing. And here in this passage, as we studied this morning, we're going to see three different groups that Jesus comes in direct confrontation with as he rides into the city of Jerusalem. The first group that Jesus confronts is the Pharisees. And we're going to start here in verse 29. Let's begin reading. It says, "And it came to pass, when he was come nigh to Bethpage and Bethany, at the mount called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying, Go into the village over against you, in the which, at your entering, ye shall find a colt tied, whereon yet never man sat. Loose him, and bring him hither. And if any man ask you, Why do you loose him? Thus shall ye say unto him, Because the Lord hath need of him. And they that were sent went their way, and they found even as he had said unto them. And as they were loosing the colt, the owners thereof said unto them, Why loose ye the colt? And they said unto the Lord hath need of him. And they brought him to Jesus, and they cast their garments upon the colt. And they set Jesus thereon. And as he went, they spread their clothes in the way. And when he was come nigh, even now at the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, Blessed be the King that cometh in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. And some of the Pharisees from among the multitude said to him, Master, rebuke thy disciples. And he answered and said to them, I tell you what, that if these should hold their peace, the stones would immediately cry out." Now, the first group that we see Jesus confronting here is the Pharisees. Now, as you read the account of Luke, or you look at the book of John, as Jesus comes down to Jerusalem, throughout his whole ministry, the Pharisees are always asking him one question: Are you the Messiah? They ask him it over and over and over and over again. In fact, tonight we're going to study Matthew 21, which happens right after this. They ask him the same question again. Here on this day, the 10th of Nisan, Jesus is going to make it abundantly clear in the city of Jerusalem that he is the Messiah. And he does it right here in this passage. And the Pharisees challenge him. Okay? A couple of things that Jesus does to show that he is the Messiah. The first thing that Jesus does to show that he comes with God's authority is he shows his mastery over this donkey. Stop and think about it for a second, okay? What kind of a donkey does Jesus get to ride into Jerusalem on? It says it's just a colt. It's a donkey that's never been ridden. Now, I got a question for you, okay? Any of you in here ever ridden a donkey? I'm looking. Anybody raise their hand? Okay. There's a couple around here, okay? Now, I grew up on a horse farm, okay? I rode lots of stubborn horses in my life. My dad would buy these horses that came off the racetrack, and my job was to ride them until someone sane could ride them. And then he would sell them, and then he'd get me another one, and I'd ride it. You know, and that was basically what I did. But I had one opportunity in my life to ride a donkey, and I don't ever care to ride a donkey again, okay? And what happened is the high school that I went to, they got this idea that they were going to do a fundraiser called Donkey Basketball. Okay, and all of us ask this question, like, what is donkey basketball? You know, we never, you know, it's like, you know, there's monkey bread, donkey basketball. We didn't know what this stuff was. So, you know, we got to this event, and I, of course, was on the basketball team. And so I got to be one of the players in this donkey basketball game. And they had us, you know, meet with this guy in charge. And we still weren't really clear how this was all going to work. And they, We get to the meeting, the guy says, it's real simple. You ride the donkey, you play basketball. And we're just like, okay, you know, do we have to dribble? No, you don't have to dribble, okay. You know, and, you know, of course, I was asking him all these dumb questions about riding, like, does the donkey rein, English and Western? He's like, that donkey doesn't rein, buddy. Just get on it, okay, and ride. So, of course, at this event, they had all of the, you know, like the teachers and the deacons, those people got to do it first, okay. And there was this spotted donkey that was literally bucking everybody off and trying to kick them. And he was out there on the court. So my youth pastor was like, hey, Harris, come here. That's your donkey. You got him, okay? We know he'll kill anybody else. He's yours. So I went out there on the court, and I got a hold of this donkey by the halter, and I had a little chat with him, and he understood that I was in charge and he wasn't in charge, okay? And if you've ever dealt with horses or animals, you kind of know how to have that chat. And so the donkey did not kick me. He did not buck me, but he also didn't move. All right? That was kind of our compromise. And, you know, I sat on the donkey, and, you know, I was doing all my posting and doing all this stupid stuff, you know, like horseback riders do. And he just stood there, like, the whole time. And, you know, he was just, like, frozen, okay? And so what I'm saying to you, donkeys are not an easy ride, okay? They're not an easy ride at all. Jesus, he comes down. He says, hey, to his disciples, go find that donkey over there that nobody's ever ridden. And you know what? They go and tie that donkey. Lead him away from its mother. Jesus gets on his back and rides him. And you know what? It's not a peaceful crowd that he rides through either. People are throwing their coats down. They're waving palm branches. They're yelling. They're screaming. The soldiers are over here. I mean, of all the places you want to make your first ride on an animal, this is not the place you want to do it. But you know what? Jesus is just showing the animals obey. The animals obey. And it's always fascinating for me to watch. As you know, the birds, they've been migrating north this year. How do they know that? They just do it, right? Because nature is at God's command. And Jesus, as he rides into Jerusalem, he's showing, you know what? I'm the one that's in control. I've got power. But Jesus' choice of a donkey is also very significant here. Okay? We sit here and, you know, we've got horses and we've got cars and we got all kinds of stuff to ride in. I don't know that anybody in here would pick, you know, I'm going to ride a donkey, okay? You know, if we were having a parade, that would probably be way down on your lower end of your list of things to pick. But in Israel, if you go back to the book of Judges, donkeys what the kings rode on. And so when Jesus picks a donkey, what he's saying is he's signifying that he is the king. In fact, what we don't understand and what these people did, especially these Pharisees, Zechariah, in the book of Zechariah, Zechariah 9:9 said, behold, your king cometh, riding upon a donkey, and the colt, the foal of a donkey. So when those disciples led that donkey in front of Jesus, they threw their coat on its back and he climbed on. Jesus said, I am the Messiah. He showed his mastery over the animals, but he also came in fulfillment of prophecy. And as Jesus was riding into Jerusalem, the Pharisees, everybody in that crowd, they knew Zechariah 9:9 because they'd been looking for that Messiah. Those Roman soldiers were there dominating their city, and they were wanting freedom from those Romans. So when Jesus got on the donkey, they knew, this is the Messiah. Here he comes. And the people responded. The people responded to him. I had Jason read Psalm 118. You're probably all sitting there, what does this have to do with Luke chapter 19? Very significant to the Jewish people. On these days leading up to Passover, the Levites would lead the people in singing the Hallel. Now you say, what is the Hallel? I ask myself the same question. It's real simple. It's Psalm 113 through 118. I'm not sure why they call it the Hallel, okay? But the people would sing Psalm 113 through Psalm 118. And as we read Psalm 118, verses 21 through 29, what did it say? It said, this is the day that the Lord hath made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. But did you see what else it said there in Psalm 118? A couple other things that it said there. Verse 22 said, the stone which the builders refused has become the head of the corner. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. This is the day which the Lord hath made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. But look at verse 25. Save now, I beseech thee, O Lord. O Lord, I beseech thee, send now prosperity. And then verse 26, blessed be he that cometh in the name of the Lord. we have blessed you out of the house of the Lord. What's that talking about? The Jews, as they sang Psalm 118, they were looking forward to their Messiah coming. And every time at Passover, every year at Passover, this was the last passage they would sing. And they would sing and say, "Blessed God, send us, save us, send the Messiah." So here comes Jesus riding into Jerusalem. He's on the donkey fulfilling the book of Zechariah 9:9. He comes down and the people are singing this verse. Verse 38 says, "Blessed be the King that cometh in the name of the Lord. Peace in the heavens and glory in the highest." They were saying, hey, the Messiah comes. Even the palm branches that the people were waving were significant, because the palm branches were not part of the worship of Passover. The palm branches instead were part of the worship of the Feast of Tabernacles, which happens in the seventh month of the year. And during the Feast of Tabernacles, the people would gather together four different branches, and they would wave them before God, signifying and praising God. And it was prophesied, the people believed, that the Messiah would come during the Feast of the Tabernacles and come dwell with the people. So here at Passover, as Jesus comes riding into Jerusalem, the people go running out. They grab their palm branches and they hold them up. Why? Because they're signifying that the Messiah is going to come. Now, just to give you a little prophecy history, the Bible tells that Jesus is coming back during that time, and he will tabernacle, he will live with his people. So there will be one day when the people will be waving palm branches, when Jesus will be coming back. That's a future thing. But the people here recognize Jesus as the Messiah. And you know what? The Pharisees also recognize Jesus as the Messiah. It's just amazing to think. As Jesus is riding down to this crowd, they're holding up their branches. They're praising Jesus. And they're praising him, saying he is the Messiah. But you look at verse 39. And you look at what happens here. Okay? It says, "Some of the Pharisees from among the multitude said unto him, Master, rebuke thy disciples." Master, rebuke thy disciples. So Jesus is riding along, and there's people praising him, and then as he goes, he comes past these Pharisees, and they're saying, hey, you control your disciples. Get them under control. They weren't telling him to make them be quiet. They were telling him to make your disciples not proclaim that you're the Messiah. They were saying, hey, you're not the Messiah. You're not the one. You need to tell your disciples that. What did Jesus say? If I tell my disciples to be quiet, the very stones are going to cry out. They're going to call out. They're going to proclaim who I am. And Jesus here is proclaiming, you know what? I am the Messiah. I am the one who is coming to fulfill all of the prophecy. I am the one who is coming to bring salvation. So Jesus confronted the Pharisees. And did he answer their question? Yeah. Did they catch it? Did they get it? No. They didn't get it. Because tonight, as we look at Matthew 21, we're going to see they come back and they continue to challenge his authority. But I think the most beautiful picture to me of this whole time is the next passage. That's when Jesus confronts the city of Jerusalem itself. Verse 41 says, "And when he was come near, he beheld the city, and he wept over it." And, you know, it's an incredible picture here. And it's hard for us to picture because we haven't been there. But Jesus came over the hill, and as he stood there, he saw this entire city laid out before him. And as Jesus was riding, his heart broke for that city. And you know what? Jesus here is showing his love to the city. You know, I just kind of stop and think. Has there ever been a city, a group of people more loved or more preached to than this city? Because if you look at the Old Testament, where did God send his prophets? He sent them to Jerusalem to tell those people to repent. He put his holy temple in Jerusalem where the people could look at that temple and they could say, hey, look, there's the temple. There is God's presence. There is God living with us. And of course, for 3 years, Jesus was there in the temple. Every Passover, Jesus was there. Every Pentecost, Jesus was there. every Feast of Tabernacles, Jesus was there. And as we read through the book of John particularly, it tells you Jesus teaching in the temple. He was there and he taught to those people. Of course, after the resurrection, when Jesus goes up to heaven, who stays there to preach? The apostles were there. The day of Pentecost happens in Jerusalem, where the city is told Jesus is the answer. And then following that, not only the apostles, but many teachers and pastors. James, Jesus' brother, was the pastor of the church in Jerusalem. He stayed there in Jerusalem and he preached to that people. You know what? There were many, 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 many people in Jerusalem who believed in Jesus, who followed him, who gave their lives to them. But there were many who weren't. There were many who rejected him. There were many who turned away from him. And you look at his words here in verses 42 through 44. And you just can see his heart of love for these people. And he says in verse 42, "If thou hadst known even now, at least in this thy day, the things which belong unto thy peace, but now they are hid from thy eyes. For the days shall come upon thee, that thine enemies shall cast a trench about thee, and compass thee round, and keep thee in on every side, and shall lay thee even with the ground, thy children within thee, and they shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knewest not the time of thy visitation." As Jesus came over that hill, and he looked at that city, he knew what was going to happen to the city. We have the advantage of looking back at this from a historical perspective. We know what Jesus was talking about. In just 40 years, almost to the day that Jesus is here riding into Jerusalem, the Romans would come. They would finally get tired of the Jews and their constant fighting against Rome. And Emperor Titus would come with his armies. And he came down into Israel in 68 AD and began just destroying the villages. Titus eventually was called back to Rome to serve as emperor, and his generals continued fighting south. And in 70 AD, they laid siege to the city of Jerusalem. Jesus said, "There's going to be a trench laid about you." The Roman legions came and they built a trench around Jerusalem. It was a horrible place to live because as they had fought down through Israel, all the Jews were fleeing before the Roman armies came and they packed themselves into Jerusalem. It was the last place, the last stand, the last chance that they had. And as we read, you can read the historical accounts of the starvation that was going on in Jerusalem. And then inside the city, as the Roman legions formed around outside the city, there was civil war that broke out in the city. They were killing each other. And the siege of Jerusalem lasted 143 days. And finally, the walls around the city collapsed. The Jews were trying to dig a tunnel out of the city. That tunnel collapsed. Big gap in the walls. The Roman legions charged into the city. And according to historian Josephus, 600,000 Jews were killed in that city by the Romans. And Jesus said there's not going to be one stone left upon another. And that's what the Romans did. They said there was a fire in the temple. And as the temple burned, the gold covering the stones melted down into the cracks. So to get that gold out, the Romans just took one stone after another stone after another stone. They pulled them to the end of that huge platform that Herod the Great had built. And they just, after scraping the gold off, they threw one stone off the edge. And Jerusalem was systematically destroyed by the Romans. And the Romans came in, and they, after all of their slaughter, they said, "We've had it with the Jews." And they began to just take whoever was left and move them all over. Many of them were sent to Europe, many to Africa, to Asia. They were spread out. And Rome said, "This place is not going to last. It's not going to ever rise up against us." And as Jesus was riding over that hill, as he looked at that city, you can just imagine him looking at those children who were praising him, thinking, when they're 50, 52, 53, 55 years old, the Romans are going to come and destroy the city. Many of them are going to be destroyed. They're going to be wiped out. And the Bible records Jesus was weeping. It's just a very strange picture because the crowds were rejoicing. The crowds were looking at Jesus. They were praising him. they were saying how wonderful and how great he was, and he was weeping. He was crying as he showed his love for that city of Jerusalem. And the final confrontation we see here of Jesus, we see it in verse 45. It says, "And he went into the temple. He began to cast out them that sold therein and them that bought, saying unto them, It is written, My house is a house of prayer, but ye have made it a den of thieves." The last group that Jesus confronts here in this passage are the money changers in the temple. Now, I want you to kind of understand what was going on here. When God commanded Solomon to build the temple, he gave very specific commands about who could go into which part of the temple. And the temple was basically, there was a place that was the place of worship where the priest could go. But outside of that place of worship, there were a couple of different courts. There was the court of men. Outside of that was the court of women. All the Jews were allowed into the court of women, and then the men could go into the court of the men. It was the closest part to the temple. But outside of that was a court of the Gentiles. Anybody that wanted to come to the temple could go into the court of the Gentiles. God had created this court for a very specific purpose. That was evangelism, we would call it, where people who wanted to know about God, they could come to the temple and they could hear teaching about God and they could know all about God. In fact, Christ himself set the example. Many, many, many times he preached and he taught in the temple. He would go to this court of the Gentiles. A lot of times he probably was on Solomon's porch. He would sit there and he would teach the people. And they would come and they would listen. He would teach them about himself. It was, God had designed this special place for teaching. But the chief priests had transformed the court of the Gentiles from a place of teaching to a place of business. And this day, the 10th day of Nisan, would have been their number one business day in the whole year. And one of the things that they sold there is they sold sacrifices. So if you came from far away, maybe you came on ship, maybe you walked down to Jerusalem, you would go into the court of the Gentiles and you would pick out a lamb or a dove or whatever the sacrifice is that you would need. And there, can you just imagine for a second? Josephus told us 256,000 sacrifices. Doesn't mean that they all were sold there. But what was this court like? I'm wondering how they even got that many sheep in there. You know, they had to bring them up the steps or chase them up the steps. Did they have pens? They had doves there that were for sale. But I don't know if that was, that probably wasn't the worst thing that happened there. The other thing that they did is they changed money. So Jews would come to the Passover from all over the kingdom. And they would bring Roman coins. And Roman coins, they were good throughout all of the Roman Empire, except one place. That was in the temple. The chief priests would not allow Roman coins to be used in the temple because it had Caesar's picture on it. In fact, they even come and challenge Jesus, right? And they say, should we pay the tax? And what does he say? Whose picture's on that money? And they say Caesar. He said, render to Caesar things that are Caesar, render unto God the things that are God's. So as these pilgrims came, the Jews from all over came to Jerusalem, they would have their money, they would have their Roman coins, they would go to the court of the Gentiles and they would exchange their coins for shekels, which were the temple coins, the official coins accepted in the temple. And so you would go to the court of the Gentiles and there would be benches, which later became known as banks, set up all around in the temple. And you would walk up and you would say, I've got this many coins, and they would give you an exchange rate. And from what we understand from history, the exchange rate wasn't good. And you know, all these guys in the temple would work together, and they would charge a pretty lousy exchange rate. So just kind of picture this for a second, okay? We know there's at least 256,000 people here. How many gold coins are piled up here? So they're taking Roman coins, and what are they doing? They're stuffing them in bags. Okay, I'm sure they got guards. You know, I don't think they had armored trucks, but they had whatever the equivalent was back then. So they got their guards. They got all this money piled up. And from what I, like our money, we can, you know, stack it up nice and neat and make those little piles and put in those little wrappers. Okay, their money, each coin was unique. So there's just big piles of money everywhere. So they were taking these Roman coins and they were stuffing them in sacks, putting them back into the vaults, and they were paying out their shekels, their temple coins. Now, you, if you were a Jew and you wanted to worship at the Passover, you had to pay the temple tax, which was one shekel. Every Jew who wanted to worship had to pay the tax. I can't imagine going to Jerusalem to worship knowing that I'm going to get charged a really bad exchange rate and then I'm going to have to pay the tax in the temple. I don't know if that would make your heart ready to worship or not, okay? But I know it wouldn't make my heart ready to worship. And if you couldn't pay the temple tax, then they would take, they would loan you money. So they would loan you Roman coins. You would exchange them for shekels. And they kept track of who owed what. And if you came the next year and you didn't have that money to pay back, well, they would give you another loan. But eventually, if you didn't pay back, they could take your land. They could take your home. They could take you and sell you into slavery. And they were using this money system in the temple as a way to gain money. It was a big business venture. And this was big business. In fact, if you check it out historically, Pontius Pilate, he built an aqueduct to bring water into Jerusalem for the Passover. And the Jews were mad because he got his money to build that aqueduct from this temple treasury. He went into the temple with his soldiers and he took the Roman coins out and he used it to pay to build. And the people were mad at him. Why? Because the chief priests wanted that money. They wanted that control there in the temple. So as Jesus rides into Jerusalem, he weeps over the city. Then he comes into the temple and what does he see? He walks into the court of the Gentiles where the Gentiles are supposed to be taught about God. And he sees people are profiting from these from this situation. They're taking advantage of all these poor pilgrims who have come to worship God. They're taking advantage of them. And Jesus walks in. And verse 45 says, he began to cast them out. And if you go and look at Matthew, it says he just started tipping over the money changers' tables. And I try to picture this in my head. I don't know. You know, Jesus, I wish I knew how to be like Jesus where you could be angry and not be sinning. And, you know, I saw a version of this the other day where Jesus wasn't angry at all. He just was teaching and pushing over tables as he was going along. We don't know what he did. We know 2 years earlier he had taken a whip and he had made it out of cords and he had driven out all the sheep that were there in the temple. But what is Jesus doing here? He's confronting these people. And verse 46, he says, "It is written, my house is a house of prayer. You have made it a den of thieves." He's quoting Isaiah 56, verse 7. And he's telling, what are you doing? You're making this place of worship into a place of profit. And it was unacceptable to Jesus. You know, in conclusion, I just want you to think about something. And the question is, what did these people want? What did these people want? The first group, the people that Jesus rode by, who were praising him and calling him the king, they wanted a personality. They wanted someone who could step up and drive out the Romans. They were looking for personality. The second group, the Pharisees that Jesus confronted, the city of Jerusalem, they wanted power. They wanted to have all the power in their hands. And that third group, the money changers, they wanted possessions. They wanted money. Give me, give me, give me money. But in conclusion, let me just ask you this question. What do you want? I want you to flip over to Philippians chapter 3. And as I close, I just want you to meditate on this passage. And I would really just ask you to take some time this afternoon, tonight, some quiet time. Just meditate here on these words here in Philippians chapter 3 and really ask the question, what do you want? Verse 8, Philippians chapter 3, verse 8 says, "Yea, doubtless, and I count all things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and to count them but dung, that I may win Christ, and be found in him, not having my own righteousness, which is of the law, but that which is through the faith of Christ, the